Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Dr. Colin Campbell, Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University, about nutrition and cancer.
That's an important topic, Christy. I can't not tell you how many times I think a week that either I read a study or someone asks me about different supplements and diet as it relates to cancer.
Right, trying to prevent getting cancer, or people who have cancer trying to take things that might help them survive and recover from that cancer in the context of their other treatment.
I'm looking forward to that conversation. But first, we also have some really interesting research that matters. We're going to be following up that conversation about opening up our medical records and our notes more to patients. We've had this conversation before.
About if your parents smoked, getting your heart checked or talking to your doctor about your heart health.
About college students, and do they change their perceptions about health issues right after getting to college? And is this concerning?
And another health-related, heart-related topic is guidelines around getting or not getting a stress test for your heart.
Well, let's talk, Christy, about this first study that was in the British Medical Journal, a very, very prominent journal, about are there really benefits about patients and doctors sharing their records? And we've talked about this a little bit before, but this is a new study.
So what we're talking about is not just being able to access your own labs and information about your appointments, but being able as a patient to see fully at any time all the notes that the doctors have in all the different settings related to your medical care.
And at least as far as this study, this was done at three different health centers, one in Boston, one in rural Pennsylvania, one in Seattle, where they looked at data on 19,000 patients and 105 primary care physicians who use this type of open note, what they call process, and they surveyed the patients and the physicians after a year and just said, you know, really basically, how satisfied are you and do you want to continue doing this? And almost all the patients wanted to continue doing this. A lot of the physicians said that they would continue doing it. Some did have some initial concerns. And, you know, we don't know whether or not this really benefited people, but they certainly talked about it in really glowing terms.
Yeah, the patients liked it. The doctors said that they would continue it. But it does raise a lot of questions for doctors around, you know, how honest are you going to be in your thoughts and process about your approach to a patient? You change that a little bit if they're reading it. If you have some concerns about their safety in the home or some things that maybe the patient hasn't disclosed yet and you're writing notes to yourself to trigger yourself to ask again next time, it changes that dynamic if you're sharing. On the other hand, you want people to fully participate in their care, and sharing of all of that together seems like it would open communication.
It opens communication, but there are some unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm.
I thought there's some funny analogies that they talked about. They said, one of the authors said, you know, it's like oysters. Once you like oysters, you hang in there with them. Well, that's assuming you like oysters. There's a lot of people who never like oysters. I don't like oysters. I don't like the way they feel and taste. I like the concept of open notes. But I wonder, if we're talking about opening up notes, we should open up all labs? Should we open up all billing practices? Open up all communication between doctors even? Open up x-rays? Who makes that decision? And what do we do when we recognize that a 20-minute conversation might take about 30 minutes to actually write and dictate that whole conversation, if you really want to capture everything that was said?
Well, and also, there's so much medical language used in those x-rays and in the doctor notes that you wonder if that would lead to more confusion on the patient's part of what does this random word mean, where we know that's insignificant, it doesn't mean anything, or, you know, we're doing all of that medical language and it's not translated for the patient. That could raise more concerns or issues.
Right. Important issue, and we should, I think we both agree that the better communication that it facilitates is really good.
Yes.
But we also want to see better health outcomes. Does this actually lead to better care? Because if it takes away time between the doctor and the patient in the exam room because they're spending more time really working on these notes, that may not actually be better care.
It's hard to know, but I hope it's the movement
stay.
That we go.
It is
yeah.
here to stay.
Okay, let's talk about if your parents smoked. So, you know, everybody has some control, although it's very difficult to quit smoking. People quit smoking. You have some control over whether or not you personally smoke. But you don't have control over what happened to you as a child, and children don't have control over what their parents do and expose them to.
Yeah, we know, Christy, I just published an essay in the Annals of Internal Medicine talking about recurrently those who purposely and perhaps recurrently expose their children to secondhand smoke is a form of child abuse. But for maybe many children, whether or not it's abuse or not, the question is, what's the impact as they get older? In this particular study that was published in the American Heart Association journal Circulation, they looked at data that from Finnish children who they had collected exposure to secondhand smoke 20 or 30 years before, then they found and looked at the what might be in the arteries as the children got older, and was there signs of carotid plaques more so in the children who were exposed to the smoke than the ones who weren't, regardless of not the children smoked?
Yeah. So the participants who had one or two parents who smoked had almost two times greater risk of having these plaques or thickening of the arteries in the heart when they were adults. So not only does it affect the health outcomes of children while they're children with asthma and other problems, but also as they're adults.
Yeah,
some outcomes.
It seems like the evidence here is so strong, and we need to change the way we think about it, that exposure to secondhand smoke and even that third-hand mm-hmm. smoke that's on the clothing are not nuisances. They're deadly for the children as when they're children, but also it predisposes them to diseases as adults. And that's something we could try to really avoid completely if we can.
Absolutely. Okay, let's talk about college students. This is a little bit disturbing, I must say, and probably more so for you as you have children in the college age range. But
this is like scary.
So this is looking at college students and their attitudes and willingness to step up and stop sexual assault or relationship violence. Surveys that were done in more than 280,000 students twice. One time they surveyed them before college, and then again 4 to 6 weeks after starting college.
Yeah, and you know, before they went to college, it turned out that 4 out of 5 of the students said they were willing to step in and kind of make, say, you know, if there was sexual violence they were witnessing or relationship violence, you know, stopping it. But 2 months into college, that number had dropped to only 55% said they would intervene. And this comes in the face of them finding out that one of every 30 female students was a victim of some sort of violence or sexual unwanted assault before their first midterm. I went, oh my goodness gracious, I knew it was bad, but that just made me sick.
I know, 1 out of 30 before her first midterm. It's really very shocking and highlights how much work we have to do in college campuses around small groups, education, prevention. I know that the universities are working on this very hard, but as a parent, that is very shocking to me.
And also, you throw the mix of alcohol in there. And I think we're going to look for, and maybe we can ask our executive producer, Eric Norrie, to help us find data that looks at curriculum on campuses. And are there existing intervention programs that can lower this? Because we would think all the students have to read a book and talk about it. Maybe all the students need to be involved in a sexual violence prevention curriculum. Does it work? Would it work?
Right. Okay, let's talk about this very last research that matters. And this is about a new guideline. So we know we have these national guidelines where they look at all the different evidence and try to give standards of care. And this is a National Association of Primary Care Physicians looking at all of this, suggesting that people who have low risk for heart disease do not need heart tests, meaning they don't need stress tests and EKGs and heart ultrasounds before or after as they decide to exercise.
And these were guidelines that were released by the American College of Physicians. And I think that these are important because it suggests that we should be having these conversations more so with our patients who are getting older, who may have heart risk factors, who may be particularly physically inactive, and helping decide who does need maybe a stress test and who doesn't. And this guidelines says that those at low risk do not. That agrees with the United States Preventive Services Task Force recommendations that said routine screening in adults at low risk doesn't need to be done. But what about these folks who are at high risk? What do we know that this is beneficial?
Right. So this is also a little confusing, muddy area, and one that we want to point you to have that shared decision making with your doctor. But the USPSTF, the big guideline group that we follow, says there's not really good information to guide us of whether people need it or don't need it.
This is if those who don't have any symptoms of the heart disease,
right,
but maybe have risk factors.
So, I mean, if you are older, if you're a man, you're over 45, over age 55 as a woman, and you have a sedentary lifestyle, you're not already exercising, you have diabetes, and you have problems with your kidneys or some other things. Well,
and you smoke.
That would put you in a higher risk kind of category, and you want
to
have
that.
Yeah, I would have that conversation.
Well, Christy, that'll conclude the Research That Matters. We're going to take a short break, but we've had a good chance to talk about this stress testing and low risk individuals probably don't need it.
Talk about college students being less likely to intervene on sexual assault after they've started college.
If either of your parents smoke, you probably should be talking with your doctor about any real risk factors for yourself.
And patients and doctors seeing some benefits of sharing medical records, and more information to come on that.
We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Colin Campbell, Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University, about nutrition and cancer. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we have the great pleasure of talking with Dr. Colin Campbell, Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University, and really one of the world's premier research scientists and authors about nutrition and cancer, and it's just great to have you here.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Campbell.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Now, tell us what sparked, I mean, you've had such a successful career. Tell us what sparked your interest in nutrition and the influence that diet can have on health and disease.
Almost accidental in some ways. I was raised on a dairy farm and eventually went away to graduate school at Cornell University, doing a nutrition and biochemistry major for both my doctorate and my master's degrees. And then I eventually came back to Cornell in 1975 and have been there ever since. And I had a large program in diet and cancer, and it started in the Philippines when I went there with my senior colleague to develop a nationwide program of feeding malnourished children and making sure that they got enough protein. But coming from the farm, you know, we thought that the more protein, the better, in a sense.
Uh-huh.
But in any case, I found something that was quite the opposite of that.
Uh-huh. Tell us.
And, well, basically, protein is obviously an essential nutrient. There's no question about that. The question is, you know, how high can we go? We generally assume for decades, a couple of centuries, actually, the more protein, the better. At least a lot of people assume that.
Yeah, I mean, Christy and I would hear in our among our parents, you know, and
gotta get your protein.
Yeah, we tell our kids, you gotta get your protein, right?
Right, and protein generally meant animal-based sources. Of course, plants have plenty of protein that we don't need more than that. But when in reality, in our experimentation, both in the laboratory as well as in a major study in China, eventually, we found that when protein is when we exceed the level we need, which can be provided by just plants. Whole food, plant-based diets, we say, when the protein level exceeds that. Lots of other things change, too. And what happens, cancer goes up, heart disease goes up, and a whole host of illnesses and so forth. And it's really quite dramatic.
If you have too much protein.
Yeah, anything over what the recommended dietary allowance is, to be honest about it.
And we're gonna get into that. But you mentioned that something happened by accident. I haven't heard any accident yet.
Okay,
what's the accident?
The accident was the fact that it came from a dairy farm, you know, where more protein. We're producing the food that, you know, gives us a lot of protein. And I was in veterinary school at the University of Georgia at the time, and the accident was the fact that I got a telegram one day from a fairly well-known professor at Cornell. Why don't you come to Cornell and do your work here? So I did, and that was an accident. And that just got me on the trail of eventually a rather large basic.
You mean if that teacher just hadn't happened to, or this professor send you and invite you, the opportunity
right.
and the relationships and the research may not have occurred.
Exactly. I mean, we all have accidents in our lives, not knowing exactly what happens next and kind of thing. So.
And thinking about your history growing up on a dairy farm, how have people received your research? As you're discovering that maybe more meat is not the answer?
Well, I've got two communities interested. One community is obviously very enthusiastic. I've given more than 600 lectures, actually, since the China study came out in 2005, all over the world, actually. And then I've got another community who don't particularly care for this message, let's be honest about it. And that's really so.
Community is that?
Well, you can probably guess.
The meat producers.
The meat producers.
The cow, the dairy.
Exactly. And the pharmaceutical companies to some extent.
Well, let's dive right in there for a second. Because you've mentioned this twice now. And, of course, those of us in medicine who study nutrition at all have heard of this study. But tell us about the China study. Because this is a really important issue as it relates to your career and the world's health.
Well, the China study is the name of the book that came out. But that's based on a project we did in China called, we call it the China Project. But in any case, we did a survey of all of China, a total of 130 villages, to see why it was that cancer was so common in some places and not in others.
This is 30 years ago.
Yeah, it started in 1983.
Okay.
And eventually we got the data all together in about 1990, and it was featured in the New York Times at the time. So it got a lot of attention. And so I was interested in that time to see what kind of dietary patterns were most related to the emergence of cancer, for starters. But then the Chinese government gave to us a lot of other disease rates, too. So we had a chance to compare a whole host of different foods and nutrient intakes compared to a whole host of disease outcomes. And, of course, in between, we're in the laboratory looking at so-called mechanisms, how does this work kind of thing. So the China study was essentially a write-up of a summary of all the work we did in the laboratory, in the field, and came to the conclusion, it was quite dramatic, that a whole food, plant-based diet, as I like to say, just has dramatic effects, not just in terms of preventing disease, but much more importantly in terms of treating existing disease. We can now reverse heart disease for virtually everyone. Cure.
Okay.
I mean, I'd like to use the word cure. I know this is a dramatic term to use, but we can do that. In my laboratory, we could turn on experimental cancer by just elevating the protein intake and then turn it off.
Wow.
And so we were able to demonstrate, unlike what a lot of people assumed and still today, we demonstrated that cancer is not a sort of a progressive kind of disease that's based on a series of mutations, for example, we could actually reverse it back to baseline and leave it there. And then we could come back and turn it back on again by nutritional means. The same nutritional means that actually operates on heart disease and diabetes.
So we want to be sure that we break this down and that we're, and I know we'll get into this more in the next segment of what you recommend, both for prevention of cancer and
right. And
you're saying it can even make certain diseases better by changing your diet. When you say this protein can then turn it back on, are you talking about any protein or are you talking about protein from animal-based
and
diet?
Why is that protein different than a vegetable-based protein? What's it different?
Or protein if somebody's taking protein shakes.
A little bit of a torturous explanation, but basically I'm talking about animal protein. Plant protein can do it if, in fact, the plant proteins, which tend to be deficient in one or two amino acids, for example, if we restore that amino acid content, we can create an animal protein-like, you know, substance. But basically, when we increase animal protein, in a theoretical sense in the laboratory, we see cancer turned on, okay? In a practical sense, when we increase our protein intake, that means consuming more animal foods. And what that has two effects. First off, we're increasing protein intake itself, and there's a lot of direct effects from, you know, in a sense in there. But as we do that, we tend to decrease the consumption of plant foods, which means decreasing the consumption of antioxidants, complex carbohydrates, and all of that. So the package
is really a package. You're filling up more on those animal meats, then you're not eating as many
exactly.
vegetables.
Well, that's what happens.
You know, there's something that seems a little counterintuitive, and help me explain it. When I think about China, I think about and particularly maybe 30 years ago, that the population would have been more vegetarian than not and eating less animal-based products. So was that not the case, or how did that then come about? Because that would not have been a common – I wouldn't have expected that finding.
That's a good question. We went to China and basically focused on rural villages where, yes, it was mostly plant-based, but there was a range. There was a range from almost zero animal foods in some of the areas all the way up to, let's say, as high as 24% of the total protein intake from animal foods in the far north.
So it almost
we had a range.
It's the fact that you were able to do an entire population and get strong epidemiologic data.
Right.
Not necessarily that you did it in China, or as it sounds like.
Well, in China, it was the only place we could really do that. First, they had an infrastructure with all the doctors who could help us. We had a big team there.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, in China, the people in the villages where we interviewed them, they were born in the villages where we surveyed them.
Wow.
So they're very static population, and they were eating local food. I mean, it couldn't have been set up better.
It sounds like it was tremendous, and what we learned from it, too. We do need to take a short break. This is fascinating. It's hard to even take a pause. But when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Colin Campbell, Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University, about nutrition and cancer. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Colin Campbell, Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University and author of hundreds of articles, best-selling books, and some films that have become really well-known across the United States and internationally about the role of nutrition and cancer and health. Dr. Campbell, tell us about how did you get into the movie-making, directing business, information dissemination?
Well, a group out of L.A. with experience in the movie industry came to one of my talks in California and got quite excited about it. So they decided to do this film that became known as Forks Over Knives, very successful.
The basic premise of that for our
The basic premise of that was they wanted to talk to myself and a good colleague, a friend of mine, Dr. Caldwell Essett in the Cleveland Clinic, who works in the heart disease areas. They wanted to find out from us what it is we're talking about. So that was just simply telling the story. Here's what it can do. And they interviewed people who actually tried it and things like that. The second film, which is just now starting, it'll be coming out July 4th. It's the official date in theater. That film is called Plant Pure Nation. And we, in fact, just had the first screening of 25 cities around the country here in Chapel Hill just last Saturday. That film is sort of trying to answer the question, why haven't we heard this before? Because I've learned in all the lectures I've given is there's one question that really stands out when people hear this because it's such a dramatic story. That's what they say. What, you know, where did this come from? I haven't heard this before. So this second film really started out with my presenting information on the floor of the Kentucky legislature. And we got quite a rousing reception, but then in reality, it turned out that when they made a resolution to sort of bring us, my son and I, into the state to work with them on helping them maybe do some things with the health system, the lobbyists came out.
Well, we are in the barbecue. We are in one of the barbecue capitals in the South as the barbecue capital of the country.
Right. Well, and in any case, that was the start of it. But then the rest of the film has to do with the fact that my son came back here in near Chapel Hill out in Mevin in that little town, and he started doing these sort of immersion programs, feeding the people the food for a week. And the results you can get in 1 week's time is truly amazing.
Well, let's talk about what that kind of food is, what you're recommending.
And why.
And why. And we're talking, the title of our show is Nutrition and Cancer. So what is the diet that people should eat to prevent or reduce their risk of cancer?
We call it, I call it whole food plant-based, because it really was all based on science. It was my program that I did for many years. We didn't use the vegetarian, vegan, or other kinds of
names, right?
Arguments, if you will, you know, as to why we got into this.
So, in fact, I was biased to the opposite point of view.
Pardon? Whole food plant based.
Right.
That means vegetables, fruits, grains, legumes, and you know, it's sort of the intact whole food form. I mean, you could take plant foods. You could take out the oil. You can take out the sugar. You could take out the white flour. You can make up, you know, donuts. You know, all plant substances, that doesn't work. It's really got to be as nature produced the food, you know, the whole food, as much as possible. And you mix and match, you put some flavors and enhancements of other kinds, you know, with the food, and you end up with your dinner.
So let me ask you two questions. One, is this about a degree? So for those who have meat or even organic, so that's two kind of questions in that. Does that make a difference? And the second question is this related to weight? Because I know Christy and I would be taught a lot in our medical training that a lot of the cancer-causing problems are due to excess weight, which is a calorie. Help us tease these things out a little bit.
Well, the first question you ask is, you know, do we need to be 100%? That varies for individuals, of course. And for anyone who has an illness of some kind, especially if it's already diagnosed, for example, they better be 100%. I mean, that's just playing it safe in a sense, but we have empirical data, in fact, to show that, you know, getting as close as we can to 100% really continues to have good effect. Now, having said that, there are some people can smoke all their lives, live to be 90, and not necessarily suffer the consequences. Same here. You know, there's a minor number of people, and we don't know who we are in that sense, who might be able to do all the wrong things and live a long time. So we know that, but they're really a minor number of people. And from the research perspective, which is what I like to rely on, is basically the closer we get to a whole food, plant-based diet, the better it is. One more thing that happens when we do it that way, we allow our bodies to begin to then develop new taste preferences.
Mm-hmm.
And that may take maybe a month or two in some cases, especially in reference to salt, sugar, and fat. I mean, and when we get off that, if we don't add back those foods, then we get into where we crave a salad. I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, I did this myself.
Well, and it tastes differently. And what is the relationship for the whole food plant-based diet with paleo?
It's exactly the opposite. I just wrote a book on, it's called The Low-Carb Fraud.
Uh-huh.
The paleo diet, the Atkins diet, the Zone diet, the South Beach diet, the, you know, you name them, they have far more in common than otherwise, and they're an attempt to actually present information to the public they want to hear.
Interesting.
It's low carb, but when it's low carb, by definition, this means it's high protein, high fat. And all the data we have, both in the short term, long term, high protein, high fat diets don't work. That's what causes heart disease and cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've debated some of these folks four times on television and elsewhere.
Uh-huh.
And they won't debate anymore because they know that's true.
And you've got science to show
that. Yeah, I've got science.
So the role of saturated fats, the role of excess weight, how do they then, are they independently related in your research to cancer, or is there a common pathway through perhaps proteins?
At the beginning of my career, and perhaps into my career, I tended to assume that kind of model. Individual things, whether it's something we measure like body weight or as doctor fat intake or cholesterol intake, we tend to parcel out, you know, these effects, if you will, in our studies. But in reality, they're a part of a total syndrome or total package. Body weight is only representative of other problems that's going on at the same time.
Because so, one could eat a plant-based diet and be markedly overweight,
that's,
and you might lose a lot of the benefit, or is that not right?
No, that's correct. I mean, there's some people who do this and still have weight problems, but they're what we call the junk food vegans. If you look at their diet more carefully.
I can understand that.
their average fat intake for the average vegan, big studies now, the average fat intake is like 30% fat. And they still have a lot of refined carbohydrates. I'm talking about 10% fat.
Now,
so, you know, vegans don't necessarily have the advantage in that way.
We need to think about take-home points for our listeners. And perhaps you have an easy reference or something we could connect on our blog that would give some tips.
Several of your books included.
Yeah, exactly. We'll link your books. But if you have tips for our listeners of where to begin. So you hear this of all these different diets, so many different fads. Where to begin to embrace this whole plant foods diet?
Well, we've certainly thought about that. And one way is write books. And so we've written books. We have the China Study. I have a second book called Whole, a more philosophical, historical kind of book, which I'm very excited about. But in any case, that came out in 2013. Then my son, who wrote the China Study with me, now a physician, he has just published the so-called the Campbell Plan. Mm-hmm. Our daughter and our daughter-in-law each have now just come out with cookbooks. Uh-huh. Our daughter came out about 2 years ago with a China Study cookbook. Our daughter, Kim Campbell, whose husband is the director of the new film, Plant Pure Nation, she just came out with a
wow,
really,
whole
very
family's
nice book.
Changing the world.
Yeah,
I know so one of your sons is a family doc, so we love to hear that. But you know, you and through your work have clearly changed the nature of conversations around the globe around some of these issues. And I guess the last question, in just for a few seconds, maybe 10 or 15 seconds, is what's that feel like? That's a tremendous responsibility.
Well, I didn't really expect it. In fact, when it came out, I didn't expect it would quite have this rousing effect in a sense. I'm really gratified. And I have to say, I'm most gratified by the talks I give to medical schools. The majority of my talks are now to medical schools. Getting doctors on board, mm-hmm. which is where I suggest we need to have physicians. They're the ones going to take the lead in the future. They're not trained in this, as I'm sure you are very much aware.
Mm-hmm.
Medical schools don't teach nutrition. They just don't. And so what we are really interested in doing that. By the way, I would like to say we have an online course called Plant-Based Nutrition.
Plant-Based
and,
Nutrition.
Yeah, that's with Cornell University and my private foundation or nonprofit. It's called nutritionstudies.org. And we have a course in there that offers CME credits to physicians.
Oh, great.
That's been it's been fantastic. It's the number one course.
Do Christy and I get credit for having you on the show today?
we'll make arrangements to see what we can talk about.
Thanks.
We really
hey,
need
thank
just
you
thank
for being
you.
With us. Yeah, it's just tremendous to think what you've done in your career and the message that you're giving. Then it's based on real science that we can trust versus a lot of these books that have a lot of pseudoscience. So.
Well, it makes people well, and I get excited about that. The reaction I get from people is incredible.
That's
a good
wonderful.
Message for your health listeners.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking with Dr. Colin Campbell, Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University, about nutrition and cancer. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. For the House Call segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And now we'll have our executive producer, Erica Nori, read us our very first House Call question of the day. Erica?
My doctor recently told me that I might have chronic fatigue syndrome, as I'm tired most days and have been that way for several years now. My doctor has ruled out depression along with 24 other diseases and disorders. Is this a true condition, and should I see alternative providers?
Well, this is a really tough issue, and we kind of thank you for that question, though. I must say, sometimes that sounds like a bunch of physicians I know, too, but for you, we're going to presume that you're not a physician, but you might have all kinds of other things that have been ruled out. And so that's one of the things that we're going to assume maybe have been done. But what do you think, Christy?
Well, chronic fatigue syndrome, it's a tricky diagnosis because it encapsulates a bunch of different sort of ways that people present, but usually involves people being really tired and fatigued for at least 6 months. That's not due to ongoing exertion, not relieved by rest, and not caused by other medical conditions. So you have
like
mononucleosis, like having mono
or
having
lymphoma,
low thyroid
Yeah, lots of things. And that's one of the problems is that there are so many things. And it sounds like your doctor ruled out 24 other possible diseases. And this is a difficult thing because then all of a sudden you're left with, okay, it's real. You've got this really bad fatigue, and we know you can't do too much exercise because this disease is also called systemic exertion intolerance syndrome. That tells us what it's about.
Yeah, and a lot of people, if you follow with your doctor, so to answer your question, yes, this is a real thing that people experience. And usually having an ongoing relationship with a doctor is a really good thing. And sometimes it involves having a plan for gradually increasing your exercise. Sometimes it involves medications or counseling or ways to sort of overcome that fatigue to be able to get things done.
Yeah, it doesn't mean you're depressed. You might be depressed because you have so little energy, but the depression doesn't cause the chronic fatigue. And that's an important piece, though. You would benefit from what's called, as you mentioned, Christy, cognitive behavioral therapy. That would work. Now, should you see an alternative provider? I think you should see any doctor that can really help you, but I'd be suspect about anyone telling you they know they've got the single best answer, particularly if it's a really expensive treatment, because there is not necessarily a quick answer to this for the great majority of people.
That's good advice. Thank you for sharing your question with us. Erica, let's take our very next house call.
I'm really embarrassed. I recently went to the doctor and told him how bad it hurt when I had a bowel movement. My doctor told me that I had fissure. I know that my diet most likely has something to do with it, but I would really appreciate any advice you could give me.
Well, don't be embarrassed because you'd be joined in company by a lot of people if we were, truth be told, fissures are common.
Yes. And it can cause a lot of pain when you have like a little tear there, right, around where you go to the bathroom. And it can hurt really bad when you go. So there are things that can make it easier, like taking stool softeners just to make sure the passage is a little bit softer and easier, fiber.
The things that we would treat hemorrhoids with of the bottom, it's the same sort of treatment. And here in this particular case, we want to let that split in the skin heal. So things that are maybe protective, like a vitamin A and D ointment or things mm-hmm. that can kind of protect and create a barrier. If that doesn't work, there are some medications, and you could see your provider or gastroenterologist, and they certainly could help you.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing. We hope you feel better soon. Let's take our next house call.
My 85-year-old mother was hospitalized with heart failure. She is now out of the hospital and is doing much better. While we were in the hospital, a doctor said that there was no reason to look further for a blockage. I was a bit surprised by this. Should we see a cardiologist?
Well, that's not an easy question, but it's a good one.
And it raises more questions for me about her history, her function at 85. If this is a very frail 85-year-old person, then going and looking for heart blockages would be, you'd ask the question, well, what would we do about it? And most of what we would do if we find it is do the same preventive medications and the same array of medicines that we put anybody who has heart failure on. And so it could be that doesn't add any information that would change the plan.
On the other hand, if your mother is really in great shape and doing well otherwise, then it might make sense to look further because there might be some different treatments. So, you know, there are some medicines that when we combine two medicines, for instance, one called nitrates with one a different sort of medication for the heart, those two things, and particularly heart failure, but it also could treat if there was a blockage. And, you know, they're doing all kinds of interventions now in people if they get older, if they're functionally in really good shape. So should you see a cardiologist? I don't know. But should you see your doctor, which could be a cardiologist, and talk about this? Absolutely.
Yeah, just trying to understand how the heart failure developed, where it came from. Is there any other treatment plan that should happen?
Erica, what's our very last house call?
I'm a young woman who becomes lightheaded pretty frequently. I sometimes think this is due to stress. A friend of mine told me that I should be checked out for hypoglycemia. How do I go about doing this?
Well, we all like the good friends who are have our best interest in mind, and thinking about other things is always a good idea because there could be other things. But if you were to take 100 people who are young, who are feeling lightheaded, the great majority probably would be stressed. But occasionally one can have other things, including occasionally heart things, occasionally hormonal things. So other things can happen.
Yes. And in a young woman feeling lightheaded often, you'd also wonder if you're anemic. Sometimes just having heavy periods or just, you know, people get a little bit of low blood counts related
Good
to
point.
Menstruation.
Good point.
So I think this whole hypoglycemia thing, one, it would be difficult to check when you're feeling dizzy to go to the doctor right then. But I do think you should go and have a big conversation about when does a dizziness or lightheadedness happen? What else is it related to? Have your doctor check some things out. It's probably not hypoglycemia.
And in order to check that out, you actually do need to get a blood sugar at the time in which you have the symptoms. Not an easy thing. Straightforward. Could be done. Talk with your doctor. Thank you for a great question. We want to thank all of our listeners for great questions today. And we want to thank all of you for joining us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. And you can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu, visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Colin Campbell. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to seeing you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.